The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Perspectives on the Border Wall, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Janet Napolitano is no stranger to border security. The former Homeland Security Secretary and Arizona governor says some physical barriers make sense, but
what doesn't make sense is to just simply say we're going to build a great wall from sea to shining sea. That, to me, is wasteful and ineffective.
And the mayor of Brownsville, Texas, tells us about the existing wall running through his border town.
The wall hasn't done anything for us.
Plus, Egyptian musician Rami Esam on being an exile from his country and no longer being able to call himself a citizen.
In my heart, yes, I am, but on papers, I can't prove it anymore.
The stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being with us this Thursday. It is day 20 now. One quarter of the federal government is still shut down, but President Trump is still not willing to budge on his demand for a border wall. Today, he traveled to the southern border himself to call attention to what his administration says is a humanitarian and security crisis there. In McAllen, Texas, the president met with border officials, and he vented frustration at the way some in the news media have described what's going on.
Every network has manufactured crisis. This is a man, every one of them. It's like they, you know, send out to everybody, let's use this soundbite today. So it's a manufacture, but it's not. What is manufactured is the use of the word manufactured. It's manufactured by them.
Outside, protesters on both sides of this political dispute were there, making themselves heard.
No border wall! No border wall!
Reynaldo Leanos Jr. is with Texas Public Radio, and he's in McAllen covering Trump's visit. As we mentioned, Ray, Trump started his visit today in McAllen. Remind us where that is and why Trump chose to travel there.
Yeah, so McAllen is located in the Rio Grande Valley of South Texas. It's literally the southernmost tip of Texas at the very bottom, right next to Mexico. And it's also the Border Patrol sector here that has the most apprehensions all along the southern border as well. So the Rio Grande Valley sector has the most apprehensions that take place along the southern border.
So the president and his administration, as we know, say there's a security and humanitarian crisis at the border. I know you spent a good part of the day today talking to people in the area. What do locals make of that claim?
The majority of the people that I spoke with today, you know, do not feel that there is a security issue on the border. I did speak with a woman who was highly anticipating, you know, the Trump arrival. Her name is Grisela Peña Navarro.
I am all for the wall. I mean, it's already started. They already spend a lot of money starting it. So I will feel so much secure if they do.
Right. So she would support a wall. McAllen, Texas, we should mention, is also home to the largest immigration processing center in the U.S. Does that at all color how people in the area, people you spoke with, how they feel about the prospect of Trump's vision of a wall?
Yes, I would say so. A lot of people had signs, you know, that say they wanted to abolish ICE. They were chanting, "My home is not a war zone." So a lot of this does play into that, you know. And I would say the majority of the people that I spoke to are anti-wall. They deeply are opposed to the zero-tolerance policy that happened here on the border as well.
Trump also held a roundtable on immigration and border security. We heard a few moments of that earlier. What else did Trump do on this trip?
Yeah, so Trump attended a roundtable discussion of immigration and border security, and he also went down to the Rio Grande and was briefed there as well.
So if Trump's goal today was to highlight, as his administration puts it, the humanitarian and security crisis at the border, did he do that?
I'm not sure. I mean, a lot of people went into this with their set views. But I will say, like, for context, within the last fiscal year, or at least within the last couple of years, apprehensions at the southern border have been between maybe 300,000 and at the most, you know, a little more than 400,000.
Per year.
Per year, correct. Yes, all along the southern border. But looking at it through, like, a historical lens, if you go back and look at CBP data, it will show that there's been times in the 80s and the 90s and the early 2000s that apprehensions along the southern border were actually at times more than a million. So I think it's important to add to this conversation as well.
Reynaldo Leanos Jr. with Texas Public Radio speaking with us from McAllen, Texas. Thank you.
Thank you.
There are already hundreds of miles of wall or fence or barrier, whatever you want to call it, running along parts of the U.S.-Mexico border. That includes Brownsville, Texas. It's a small city 60 miles southeast of McAllen, where President Trump is today. And for about 10 years, Brownsville residents have been living with an 18-foot barrier between them and their Mexican neighbors. Tony Martinez, Brownsville's mayor, tells us that not everyone's thrilled about it.
It had a lot of resistance. There was a lot of landowners that didn't want it. They still don't want it. There's some that it basically divided their land. The Catholic Church is fighting it still today for an area up the valley. The university fought it. The city fought it.
Yeah, just one clarification. I mean, it's called a border wall, but the Rio Grande down there in Brownsville, that is the actual border, isn't it? So the wall itself, the barrier, is in the U.S.
No, that's correct. You know, if you were actually to put it on the border, you'd have to put it in the middle of the Rio Grande. And as we all well know, rivers have a tendency to meander, so that would be a very difficult task. And so some of these landowners, they have a wall that they have to get through to go to their other part of their land, which is actually still in the United States, but it's going right through their land.
And then in 2017, I understand the Brownsville City Commission passed a resolution against construction of Trump's border wall. Was this concern about something bigger than a fence in Brownsville or general opposition to Trump's idea of a wall from sea to shining sea? And why was it passed?
You know, I would tell you that in my view, the wall hasn't done anything for us. I mean, I think if you talk to the Border Patrol, you might say, well, we monitor the wall by virtue of technology and cameras, et cetera. And it may create a little bit of delay for someone who's trying to cross, which gives us a little bit of lead time to go to that area. But it's not been effective. That's not where the drugs are coming in or the smuggling and things. They're coming through the ports of entry. And besides that, I think from an optic sort of view, Brownsville and Matamoros is the Mexico city that's right across the river from us. And we are sister cities, and we are good friends and families. And it's sort of like moving into a neighborhood, and your next-door neighbor is one of your best friends. And the next thing you do is you build a wall so that they can't come onto your property going like, what is this all about? And you say, well, I didn't put it there. The government did. That's basically an analogy of what's going on is someone else put it there. We didn't put it there.
Have there been no pockets of concern in Brownsville for the violence and narco-trafficking in Matamoros that could potentially come across the border?
You know, we have really wonderful law enforcement. And the second thing is the cartels are as smart as any other corporate entity in the sense that if they bring any violence into American soil, then you really bring in the wrath of probably your army, Navy, Coast Guard, whatever it is. They run their ship as good as anybody in the United States, and they're not going to be silly enough to try to come in here and create any security problems in Brownsville because they'll incur the wrath of the United States defense team.
Mayor Martinez, tell me about your own personal relationship with the border.
Well, you know, I'm a lifelong resident of this area, and my dad came across from Mexico and became a naturalized citizen. I was born here, and it's a typical immigrant type of family situation, first generation. And so in Brownsville, we're bicultural, we're binational, we're bilingual, we speak Spanish as much as we speak English. So it's part of where we came from and part of where we're going.
Tony Martinez, the mayor of Brownsville, Texas, very good to speak with you. Thanks for your time.
Marco, thank you very much.
None of this stuff is really new. Politicians have been arguing about border policy for years.
When I was governor, I would say, show me a 10-foot wall and I'll show you an 11-foot ladder. And I still believe that to this day.
Janet Napolitano was Arizona governor from 2003 to 2009. She went on to be Secretary of Homeland Security under President Obama. But as the governor of a border state, Napolitano signed off on building sections of a border wall. She says that was part of an overall strategy.
I thought that having some barriers in some areas strategically placed, you know, made sense. What doesn't make sense is to just simply say we're going to build a great wall from sea to shining sea. That, to me, is wasteful and ineffective.
Yeah, but right now, hundreds of thousands of people are out of work and furloughed. Do you think Democrats in the White House should cut a deal that includes some physical barriers?
No, and I think Congress, even when it was under the control of the Republicans, didn't pass funding for the wall. And I think what should happen is the president should reengage with the Congress on what is truly needed for a border security strategy. And in the meantime, they ought to reopen all the elements of the government that are currently shut down.
So leaving aside whether they should, will they in the end settle on a deal that includes money for building some kind of barrier or wall?
I can't say, but right now it doesn't seem likely that they will.
We're hearing so many mixed messages from people who work along the border. I went on a ride along a couple of years ago with two border patrolmen, and they said a wall is not needed. More personnel are. I also hear from others in CBP that they would like a wall. The White House says they do, but of course they have an interest in saying so. What did you hear at Homeland Security, and what are you hearing now? Do you think the people in the trenches want a wall?
No. Many people in the trenches want to support the president, and I respect that. I personally disagree with it, but I respect that. And because they want to support the president, they're going to support the president's call for the wall. But when you really talk brass tacks with them about what is actually needed at the border, they'll talk about things like manpower. They'll talk about things like more technology. Drones and sensors, night vision equipment, things of that sort. Those are the things that make sense to the average Border Patrolman.
You believe a wall is not needed, and that's what you're hearing from people in Customs and Border Patrol. I'm also hearing from other Border Patrol people that if money and resources were reassigned to more officers and if a wall were there, they could do that and they'd be freer to patrol upland 20, 50 miles into the desert. Doesn't that make sense?
I've heard that argument. There's already 700 miles of fencing along the border, and it may make sense to add a few sections more in strategically located areas. But that's not what the president is talking about. The president is talking about building 1,954 miles. It would have to cross private land, and the private landowners don't want it. It would have to cross an Indian reservation, the Tohono-O'odham Reservation in Arizona. The tribe doesn't want it. It would be expensive. It would take a long time to build, and it would be a real actual distraction from a border security plan that makes sense.
Janet Napolitano, you're a product of America's West. I think it's fair to say you were the first Democrat to be reelected as Arizona's governor in what was once a solidly red state. I'm thinking you may see ways to compromise a path through this current impasse. What do you think others with a different mindset are missing?
I think the president ought to start talking about border security and not a wall. And he ought to expand his thinking to include the things that have been included in CBP strategies for protecting the border. It's things like extra manpower. It's things like more technology. It's things like air cover along the border. And he ought to say, you know what? We're going to disagree on the wall. I'm still going to ask for it. It's still going to be in my presidential budget. But these are other things that make sense that I think we can agree on. So let's get some funding for that. And I'm going to continue to fight for the wall. You're going to continue to say no, but we're going to see if over time I can persuade you that I'm right about that.
Janet Napolitano served as Secretary of Homeland Security from 2009 to 2013 under President Barack Obama. She has a new book coming out in March, How Safe Are We? Thank you very much, Janet Napolitano. Good to speak with you.
Thank you.
For my full interview with Janet Napolitano, head over to theworld.org. A quick look ahead now to a story coming up later in the show. When Egypt's authoritarian leader Abdel Fattah el-Sisi ran for president last year, musician Rami Esam co-wrote a song with a poet pretty much calling the government stupid.
So it went really viral and it made a great impact according to the movement. But in the same time, what happened after was so sad that the poet Galal Bahiri is in jail at the moment and he is spending a 3-year sentence that came out from the military court. this is the same shit going on. The military is still like controlling everything, and it's the same corruption getting more. Freedom of expression is dead.
That story coming up a little later here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. His critics call him an illegitimate president, but today Venezuela's Nicolas Maduro was sworn in for a second term. Never mind that the U.S. and most of the countries in Latin America are refusing to recognize his reelection. They say the vote last May was not free and fair. One sign of the political tension today, normally the swearing-in ceremony for a new presidential term is held at the National Assembly, but with that body under opposition control now, Maduro began his new term, taking the oath at the Supreme Court, which, by the way, is packed with his political allies. Guillermo Olmo reports from Caracas for our partners at BBC Mundo. He says many Venezuelans could not care less about the change of venue.
Well, most of them don't seem too concerned about the president's new term, but rather they seem to be concerned about the economy, about their everyday difficulties they have to endure, how hard it is to get the basics they need, and especially how the price rises are running crazy and are making a living here harder, very much harder.
Yeah, so since Maduro first came to power 6 years ago, succeeding the very charismatic predecessor, Hugo Chavez, how significantly have the conditions in Venezuela deteriorated?
I would say that the country's economy were doing well during the last years of Chavez's president term. But since Maduro stepped into power, things have gone really, really worse. And now the country is living what the IMF has described as one of the worst economic crises ever. And this is the reason why over 3 million people have left this country over the last few years and why it's been so difficult to make ends meet here for average Venezuelans.
You mentioned, Guillermo, the Venezuelans fleeing their country, thousands each day as the economy there continues to plummet. What are Venezuelans hoping for right now?
Well, that's a tough question. I guess they want to live in a normal country. That's what I feel when I talk to them. And they don't understand why their country has to be in such a poor condition and has to be always in the headlines, in the global headlines, for bad news. I guess these people wish normality, just to have the things that people in developed countries take for granted, like, well, food for your family and a decent job. But this country has been in turmoil for more than 10 years, I would say, and it's going to be hard to fix the situation.
The dilemma for Venezuela continues. Guillermo Olmo, reporting from Caracas for our partners at BBC Mundo. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
You're going to work yourself to death. You've heard that before. It might sound like an exaggeration, but maybe not if you live in Japan. As Ibi Caputo reports from Tokyo, many Japanese are working such long hours, they're literally putting their lives at risk. But some employers, along with the government, are paying attention.
Every workday at the Tokyo offices of the construction company Mitsui Home, you hear this at 6 p.m. sharp. Everyone in the office stands, and one by one, they tell their manager what else they have to do for the day and when they'll head home. Naoki Takani is a spokesperson for Mitsui Home. The Rocky music energizes people to finish up their work as soon as possible. And for those who need to have dinner with clients, it cheers them on for a successful evening. Takani says this 6 p.m. ritual has increased efficiency and decreased overtime significantly. He says without that, people would just continue to work on and on. That tendency to overwork is in no way unique to the home construction industry in Japan. It's such a problem that the Japanese even have a word for it, karoshi, death from overwork. Stories of karoshi have made headlines in recent years. There was the young political reporter who suffered heart failure after working 159 hours of overtime and only getting 2 days off in a month. She was found dead in her bed, still holding her cell phone. There was a woman from an ad agency who jumped out of a window after tweeting, "I'm going to die, I'm so tired." And then the overworked maintenance employee who killed himself a year after his resignation was rejected.
In Japan, people are working overtime because it's just too much work for one person to handle.
Yohei Tsunami is a lecturer at Chiba University of Commerce. He says Japan faces some serious problems. It has a declining population and a labor shortage. Tsunami says companies need to consider whether more jobs can be automated.
What needs to happen is that we have to cut down on the volume of work that needs to be tackled and also improve the employer-employee relationship.
Tsunami says labor unions in Japan don't have a lot of power, which makes it hard for workers to seek protections, and that includes overwork. Japan's Ministry of Health, Labor, and Welfare classifies karoshi as the sudden death of an employee who works more than 80 to 100 hours of overtime a month. The most likely causes are heart attack, stroke, or suicide. According to a government report, nearly a quarter of the companies surveyed had employees who worked those kind of hours. Yamato Nakamura used to be a middle manager at a gas company.
The time card automatically punches out at 8.5 hours a day. So I come into work, and I'm supposed to leave at a certain time, but actually, I was working much more than that.
During the day, Nakamura says he would inspect pipeline construction, and at night, he'd process paperwork, not just his own, but his boss's, too. Nakamura says he became very depressed and couldn't sleep.
It got really serious. I was getting medication for the depression, but I kept working. It got so bad that one day I jumped onto the railroad tracks. I just couldn't control myself.
He says he attempted to kill himself 3 times.
But each time, at the last minute, my mother's face popped into my head, and I would start crying and I couldn't go through with it.
Nakamura is 37 now and no longer works. The gas company fired him 2 years ago, he says, because he was diagnosed with a mental disorder. He takes 15 pills a day to function. He says he and his wife have decided not to have children because of his depression. For now, he volunteers with an association that supports the families of karoshi victims.
I'm connected through Twitter with many who have a similar condition as mine. There are others who really have much more serious problems than I do. So I'm hoping to be able to hear their grievances, to be able to give them advice.
Nakamura says he hopes he can get better one day and return to work. In 2017, the government released a list of hundreds of what it calls black companies that violate labor laws in an effort to shame employers. But then last year, legislation was passed that caps overtime at 100 hours a month, even though the labor ministry has established that people who work that much are at risk of karoshi. Critics say this high cap could lead to more deaths from overwork. For The World, I'm Ibi Caputo.
We have information about suicide prevention over at theworld.org. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo outlines U.S. policy for the Middle East with a speech in Cairo and takes aim at President Trump's predecessor.
I was a bit taken aback when he criticized President Obama in a very clear, explicit way.
That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. In his speech today in Cairo, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo tried to convey 2 things. One, reassurance.
The United States under President Trump has reasserted its traditional role as a force for good in this region.
And then a loud and clear reset of U.S. policy in the Middle East.
The good news is this. The age of self-inflicted American shame is over, and so are the policies that produce so much needless suffering.
Pretty clear who he's talking about there. The BBC's Sally Nabil was in the audience today when Mike Pompeo spoke to an audience at the American University in Cairo. She says it's pretty easy to sum up the speech.
If you want to put some headlines for his speech, it's criticism for Obama's strategy in the Middle East, curbing Iran's influence in the region and the fight against radical Islam. I was a bit taken aback when he criticized President Obama in a very clear, explicit way. He was bluntly criticizing Mr. Obama's strategy in the Middle East, and he named specifically Iraq and Syria, where Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian president, bombed his people with sarin gas, according to Mr. Pompeo. And he said America at that time, they condemned the act, but they did nothing about it.
Yeah, so the big headline, I guess, is Obama let you down, the Trump administration has your back. But what did we actually learn from Pompeo specifically about Trump's policy in the Middle East?
Actually, he was very concerned with Iran. It's one of his key points in his speech. And he even said that Iran now has a cancerous influence in the region, in Syria, in Yemen, in Iraq. And he said that now the sanctions, the American sanctions on Iran, they are much stricter than ever, and that the U.S. will continue to get tougher and tougher until Iran acts like a normal country, according to him.
What about Pompeo's notion that America is a liberating force for the Middle East, not necessarily an occupying force? I mean, how is that heard?
We can put that into the wider context of the war in terror, which Mr. Pompeo talked about very clearly. I mean, he came here to the region with a reassurance to the Middle East partners that, yes, we have decided to pull out our troops in Syria, but we are not doing that immediately. Nobody knows when. He refused to give a timeline, and that when we pull out, that does not mean necessarily that we are quitting the fight against the so-called Islamic State group. And he said clearly that America will not pull out until the mission is done. But he also referred to the fact that partners in the Middle East should do more. And this raises a lot of questions, because some reports have been predicting that the U.S. administration might ask some Arab partners like Egypt, like Jordan, like Saudi Arabia, like the United Arab Emirates to send forces on the ground in Syria to replace the U.S. troops when they pull out on one hand, and to curb the influence of Iran and its proxy forces on the ground on the other hand.
Pompeo also blamed recent ISIS attacks in Iraq and the rise of ISIS on President Obama because he pulled troops out of Iraq. But at the same time, Pompeo and Trump say the U.S. can't be the world's policeman. Won't a lot of people in the Mideast see that as a contradiction?
Yeah, this is true. And to be honest, the decision to pull out U.S. troops from Syria took so many people by surprise. And even when Pompeo made a surprise visit to Iraq yesterday, a lot of reporters asked him if the U.S. is going to do the same in Iraq. We have about 5,000 U.S. troops in Iraq or a bit more. And he didn't answer. I think it's fair to say that what's going behind closed doors in this trip is far more than what we know or what the public know. Mm. The statements for the press are very brief, and they are very generic and very fluid, and you can't have any specific piece of information regarding anything. He's just laying very broad lines, and perhaps he's still waiting for more talks with regional leaders to come up with a concrete strategy about how things are going to go in the coming months.
Finally, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, the host for Mike Pompeo today, and there was praise from the Secretary of State for Sisi. But Sisi is the focus of a lot of human rights critics, and many believe that Egypt is worse now under Sisi than under Hosni Mubarak. How is Pompeo's praise of him likely to go down among Egyptians?
Actually, many Egyptians believe that the current relationship between Sisi regime and the Trump administration is far better than the relationship between Sisi's regime and the Obama administration. And this is because the Obama administration used to press more when it comes to human rights violations in Egypt. But the general understanding here in Egypt is that the Trump administration does not see the issue of human rights as a priority at all. It's all about the fight against terror and radical Islam, and he sees that the current president, President Sisi, is doing a good job. And Mr. Pompeo made that very, very clear, whether in his press conference or in the speech that he gave in the American University in Cairo.
The BBC's Sally Nabil speaking with us from Cairo. Really appreciate your time. Thank you, Sally.
Bye-bye. Have a good day.
A New Beginning. That was actually the title of the 2009 speech delivered by Barack Obama, the same venue where Pompeo appeared today, the American University of Cairo.
I've come here to Cairo to seek a new beginning, between the United States and Muslims around the world. One based on mutual interest and mutual respect.
Obama was a newly elected president. He promised to end the U.S.-led war in Iraq. There was a sense that his speech would be the start of something different. Today, Pompeo's speech was at times a direct rebuke of Obama's. Magdi Abdelhadi is a political commentator. He remembers how Egyptians reacted to Obama back in 2009.
People just loved him. I remember interviewing Egyptians on the streets of Cairo, and people felt as if he was one of them. Some of them, of course, aware of the fact that he has a middle name, Hussein. So there was that Muslim affinity, if you like. I remember at one point, one of the members of the audience shouted, "We love you, Obama." That didn't happen, of course, with U.S. Secretary of State Pompeo's speech at the AUC in Cairo today. So it was a vastly different context back then.
Well, embedded in Obama's speech was, as you say, a message of hope for the Arab world. And today, it's a message that Pompeo mocked. Let's listen to that.
He told you that the United States and the Muslim world needed, quote, a new beginning, end of quote. The results of these misjudgments have been dire.
So, I mean, what do you think, Magdi? Was Obama too idealistic? What did he get wrong?
I mean, this is a thing, an issue that will preoccupy historians for many years to come. Was the Middle East ready for democracy at that moment? Because the outcome of the uprisings, chaos and bloodshed in Libya and Syria, which continues in Egypt, it empowered a religious political organization that is anything but democratic. In fact, in many people view it as a religious fascist movement, the Muslim Brotherhood. And the question is, was Obama right to support that? I don't think the jury is still out. It depends who you put that question to. So in a sense, he was wrong to have, couldn't see that coming. And any observer of the Middle East would tell you that at the time, Obama may have done the right thing, but with hindsight, it was disastrous.
When you look at the substance of Pompeo's speech today, what do you think are the biggest differences between his message and the one Obama had in 2009?
I think it is very obvious that he is focused on fighting radical Islamic ideology and containing Iran. To be fair to Obama, Obama does mention and spend some time actually talking about extremism and violent extremism in the name of Islam. He doesn't use the word Islamic extremism or Islamic terrorism because of the controversial nature of that expression, but he does dwell upon that in his speech. So in that respect, both Secretary of State Pompeo and Obama do share that concern. But it's a question of emphasis. Mm. Pompeo's speech was much shorter. It was sort of head-on from the very start. Let's be very frank about this. That is the problem with the region. Radical Islamic ideology, violent Islamic extremism is something, is a threat that concerns America and also concerns the people of the Middle East. And he had some praise for those leaders in the Middle East, in particular President Sisi of Egypt, who said as much and are engaged in fighting, at least militarily.
Do you think people across the Middle East will listen to Pompeo saying Obama was too timid when it came to religious extremism? Yeah, Pompeo is right. We agree with him. Obama let us down. Will they be saying that?
Some people definitely would be saying that, and particularly the regime here in Egypt. This is music to the ears of the regime and many of its supporters, and would like to see the words backed up by action, whether it is financial support or military support that the Americans can give to governments or groups that are engaged in that fight. But I think overall, people are still extremely skeptical and suspicious of America's intentions, because still much of what America says and does is seen through the prism of America's support, unstinting support to the state of Israel. And when this comes into the picture, the wider public is extremely skeptical to what America says and does.
Magdi Abdelhadi, a British-Egyptian political commentator, speaking with us from Cairo. Thanks as always, Magdi.
Thank you.
President Obama's Cairo speech seems a long time ago now. So does the Arab Spring that followed a couple of years later. At the time, in 2011, it looked like Egypt and a lot of the Arab world were on the verge of massive change. Right in the thick of it, Egyptian musician Rami Essam. That's Essam's song, Erhal. It means leave, as in dictator Hosni Mubarak must leave. Erhal became the anthem of the Tahrir Square protests in Cairo that would lead to the overthrow of Mubarak. A lot has happened in Egypt since then. The revolution that toppled Mubarak was suppressed, its leaders thrown in jail. A new authoritarian president took power, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. And a year ago, Sisi actually ran for president for the first time. There was little actual chance that he'd lose the election, so Rami Essam wrote a new song for the occasion. The song is called Balaha. Balaha means date, as in the fruit. Rami Essam says it also means something else.
It's just like a way of people saying somebody is stupid or dumb. We made Balaha to criticize the first 4 years of the government and just try to raise awareness before the election so people can really think and try to choose something else, if there was something else, but there wasn't.
Which, Essam says, is pretty much just like things were back under Mubarak. So is what happened to the man who wrote the song's lyrics.
So it went really viral and it made a great impact according to the movement, but in the same time what happened after was so sad that the poet Galal Bahiri is in jail at the moment and he is spending a 3-year sentence that came out from the military court. This is the same shit going on. The military is still like controlling everything and it's the same corruption getting more. Freedom of expression is dead.
One thing that is different, Rami Essam isn't living in Egypt anymore. He says it's too dangerous for him there. He's currently in exile in Sweden and he says his passport was revoked.
So technically, I guess that means you're no longer a citizen of Egypt?
In my heart, yes, I am. But on papers, I can't prove it anymore. And on the practical level as well, it wasn't easy because I lived almost the whole 2018 paperless in Scandinavia. I couldn't go anywhere.
Essam finally can travel. We spoke in New York last weekend after he'd performed at a fundraiser for the Artistic Freedom Initiative. I asked him why, if things are as bad as ever in Egypt, people aren't protesting.
I know very well that people are so exhausted, and sadly that the new government managed to put fear inside the people again, and there are definitely more than 60,000 political prisoners, plus the people that are getting tortured in jail or getting killed in jail, and if things still going like this, it wouldn't stay like this forever.
When we last spoke in 2011, you said that one of your hopes for the future was that you'd be able to help more musicians in Egypt grow. How much have you been able to do that? And what are your hopes for kind of other musicians stepping out and being vocal?
I'm sad that I couldn't start yet to really do the support and the help that I want to do to my colleagues back home. I hope that I inspired any of the younger generations that they can pick up good cause and say something meaningful and helpful for the people. But on the other hand, I can't wait to start in the future any way to really, really help the artists back home, especially when now I'm abroad, I'm away, and I can work, I can tour the world, I have much more freedom than them there. And one day I will help the whole movement back home. This dream never leave me.
I want to know what you miss about Egypt, about Cairo.
I love the craziness in Cairo. I miss the traffic of Cairo. It might sound stupid. I even miss the pollution of Cairo. I don't know how to say that, but I miss the smell of Cairo. I miss the people. I miss the city that doesn't sleep. And I miss feeling home.
What would it take for you to actually return home?
If I go back at the moment, I'll be arrested, for sure. And who knows in the future how that will change and when it will change and when I will be able to be back home. But I can't wait to be back home for sure.
Egyptian musician Rami Essam, exclusively here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World.
All the attention today on President Trump's visit to the Texas-Mexico border means we're hearing a lot, again, about his argument to build his wall. Essentially, he says the nation's security needs it to make the border with Mexico harder to cross. Let's consider a different option, a U.S.-Mexico border that's easier for travelers to navigate in both directions. I know, radical thought. It came up yesterday in my interview with Mexico's former ambassador to the U.S., Arturo Sarucan, which you may have heard. We'd been talking about the old North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. That's when I asked him this. Speaking of NAFTA, do you believe that the goals of NAFTA are ultimately consistent with free movement of people between the three countries? Like, and I know some people will freak out when I say this. Do you believe the border should actually be loosened between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada?
Look, I think that's a very divisive and toxic debate right now, precisely because of how immigration has become a third rail inside GOP politics and how the president is using that to rally and mobilize his hardcore base. That's why he retained the Senate in the midterms in November, by playing up the fears of the migrant caravan from Central America on the Mexican border. It is obvious that one of the issues that was never dealt with in the original NAFTA, labor mobility, is a difficult issue. That's why, again, it doesn't figure prominently, even though there's this chapter on North American visas, which allows mobility of professionals, engineers, doctors, to be able to move between Canada, Mexico, and the United States. But if you look at probably the most accomplished success story that we have today in the world, which is the European Union, which is being challenged, by the way, precisely on one of these issues, which is labor mobility. Labor mobility, at the end of the day, has to be regulated, has to play in, because it will provide strength to the North American market. If you look at the demographics of the United States in 20-25 years, it won't have the doctors, the nurses, the workers. Those can come from Mexico if we find legal, orderly, transparent, safe ways of allowing people to come with a visa to work and then come back and forth in a legal, orderly manner. That, I think, should be the end of the game. I don't think we're anywhere close to having that debate, at least with the United States today.
Yeah, think about that. Just an intriguing moment in my interview with the former Mexican ambassador to the U.S., Arturo Sarucan. You can hear more of our conversation at theworld.org. Now to Italy, where immigrants have increasingly been feeling unwelcome. Recently, the Italian government passed a law that makes it harder for people to win asylum there. But we're going to hear now about a small project in Florence that is trying to extend a hand. Here's Anna Benstead with the story.
At the edge of a small Tuscan town's grand piazza, a group of 20-somethings gets ready to board the local bus for Florence. Around the same time in Florence, another group of young people makes their way towards one of the city's historic palazzi. The two groups have never met before, and they've arrived in Italy with very different life experiences.
I would say the journey was a very difficult one. Because many died on the road. Lack of water, lack of a lot of things, you know.
I really wanted to get out of Santa Rosa, get out of kind of the bubble that I lived in my whole life, you know, staying with my parents and things.
The guys on the bus are young men, migrants from sub-Saharan Africa. Those in town are study abroad students from California, and they're part of a new program that sets out to connect the two groups. It's organized by the American Institute for Foreign Studies to give their students an understanding of Italy beyond its great art and gelato. And by a migrant reception center in Fiesole, keen to make its residents feel less isolated.
Thank you all for coming, and I look forward to your vigorous participation.
The room in the palazzo where they all meet up gets quiet as Ibrahim from the Gambia talks about his harrowing journey across the Mediterranean.
During the course of the rescue, the boat capsized, and some people, like roughly 11 people, died in that instant. So it was hard.
Ibrahim and the other young men here don't want to use their full names while they await their hearings for asylum. After the forum, Spencer Nathurda, a student from California, says the stories were eye-opening for him, but there was one thing that he couldn't get over.
What stuck out to me the most is when we talked to the men about their stories, they all had a theme of saying how lucky they were I had heard their stories, and I would never have called any of them lucky for what they went through, the hardships and the trials and the violence that they went through. I would never call one of them lucky, but I was so surprised that these men had gone through such hardships and such pain, but they weren't hardened coming out of it.
Franklin from Nigeria says he's just grateful to Spencer and the others for listening.
Because it's been a long time ago, I talked to someone with an open heart and hoping that the person would listen, just like he did. I said, it made me feel like someone, yeah.
A few days later, the American students take the bus up the hill to visit the young migrants in the former convent where they're staying. There's some sharing of music and a meal. Coconut rice, plantains and turkey wings from Sierra Leone, tacos from California.
I really can't. No, I really can because I ate everything and it was delicious.
After the dinner, Nosa Abba from Nigeria and Michelle from California chat on the open terrace. For Michelle, the stories she's heard seem especially personal.
I have immigrant parents and I was an immigrant myself until I became a resident 6 years ago, so I understand where they're coming from. So I'm originally from Morelos, which is 2 hours south of Mexico City. So when they would tell us their story, one of them addressed that they came to Italy just to have a better life. And that touched me a lot because that's what my parents did. They wanted to have a better life, especially for my brother and I. So hearing them, just like, wow, it's so similar. It's a big world, but in reality, it's a very small world because you have so much stuff in common. You don't know until you start talking to them. Just so nice.
Yeah, that's true. You know, some of us, we came, you know, because a lot of us don't have this belief to make it anymore in our country. That's the most reason why you see a lot of Africa trying to smuggle out of the country just to seek for a better life. And being an immigrant is just a condition and the situation and the wind of life.
Nosa Abba and the other young migrants here face an increasingly uncertain future in Italy now. But these meetups have created some unexpected connections, as well as some greater understanding of what it's like to be an immigrant. For the world, Anna Benstead, Fiesole, Italy.
One small project, but sounds like some pretty big steps there toward greater understanding. That's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.